Our next case is United States v. Ramirez. Ms. Cassar, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Miller, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Morning, members of the court. Always a pleasure. Your Honors, the military judge abused his discretion in not allowing the defense to inquire into racial bias during voir dire, and his failure to do so constitutes reversible error. The Supreme Court said in Pina Rodriguez v. Colorado that voir dire is one of the standard safeguards to prevent racial bias from deliberations. Just last month, this court said in United States v. Jeter, we cannot blind ourselves to the fact that the military justice system, its member selection process in particular, remains vulnerable to actions by those who harbor outdated views regarding women and minorities. This case is example A of why that is true. In voir dire, if we sort of take a look back, what we know is that both First Lieutenant L.H. and Mrs. L.H. are of Caucasian descent or appearance, while the appellant is Hispanic. The military judge clearly knew the race of the accused, as did the panel. In proposed voir dire, the defense requested to ask, does anyone's cultural background influence your perception of relationships between individuals of different races? This put the issue squarely before the military judge.
So, Mr. Cassara, you, in your brief, and now when you're speaking here for oral argument, you understandably put this in the context of constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury, the important issue of racial bias and so forth. But could this case also be viewed through a different prism, one that's very much more mundane in terms of, rather than the failure of the military judge to allow the question, the failure of trial defense counsel to lay an adequate factual predicate?
No, and I will tell you why, Judge. There's a couple of reasons why. This is the only area of voir dire where a military judge would require, or where an appellate court would require, an accused to establish why he wants a question asked. We do not do that in any other area of the law. So, for example, in this case, when the government asked, would any of you, of the panel members, be unable to convict because there is no evidence of physical violence? The military judge wouldn't require, and if the appellant had asked the question, this court wouldn't require, well, put on a proffer as to why that is true. We see routine voir dire cases in which a defense counsel asks, does anybody on the panel not drink alcohol? Clearly, that's a key to the military judge, that alcohol is at play in this case. We would not ask an accused to say, well, proffer for us whether or not alcohol is involved in this case. The asking of the question itself puts the issue squarely before the military judge.
Now, why is that? I admire the fact that in your brief you didn't state specifically that this was presented to the military judge. You indicated that it was signaled. I think you said that it provided heads up. Here you're talking about gave the military judge a cue. But why should this court hold that that is adequate? Why isn't it incumbent upon the trial defense counsel to state simply, my client identifies as Latino, the victim in this case does not identify as Latino, therefore I want this instruction?
Because SCOTUS doesn't require that.
But why shouldn't we require that?
Because there is no, again, there's no other area of the law, and especially and certainly during voir dire, when we are talking about an issue that is this fundamental to a fair trial, there.
So if it's so fundamental, then why wasn't incumbent upon trial defense counsel to raise that issue? Particularly in light of the fact that the military judge said, here's how I'm ruling, but three times in three different ways said, I'm inviting you to ask me to reconsider my ruling here, counsel.
Because,
and he didn't do it.
Well, because look at the reasons why, and it's interesting that, you know, as we were going over this case and we're saying, well, the military judge checked a box. He literally checked a box. He did not do any analysis on the record. There was nothing to ask for reconsideration of, and there's no requirement on the law under the law that you can.
Why not, at a minimum, ask for clarification? All right, the box that he checked gave three potential reasons why he was doing away with that question. Why not, at a very minimum, ask for clarification about which of the three reasons it was? Like, what burden is there at all? The military judge has extended an invitation to get clarification, to challenge, to present additional questions. And this happened with some of the other questions, right? Some of the other questions that he also checked the box on then got reformulated or combined, or they got the issues were resolved. None of that happened with this question. It was just abandoned by defense counsel.
I don't know, as I've gone through this case, Judge, I don't know of a better way, for lack of a better term, you know, and the Army Court says that the question was too broad. Nowhere was that raised, that it was too broad. The judge gave these three possible reasons.
But it wasn't raised by defense counsel, right?
I'm sorry, what
but you said that it wasn't raised in the trial, but the reason it wasn't raised is because the defense counsel sat on their hands.
No, that's not what I said, Judge, just so we're clear. It wasn't, it was
Mr. Kucera, can you pull the microphone
sorry,
more up?
I'm sorry, Judge.
We're speaking to it more.
Yes, Your
Thank
Honor.
You.
Thank you, Judge. My point, Judge, is that the defense counsel had nothing to ask for reconsideration of, in the sense of the question was asked, the military judge denied it. There is no case law that this the appellant counsel is aware of, either at this court, a service court, or the Supreme Court, which says you then have to jump up and down and ask the judge to clarify.
I mean, you're asking for a per se rule that if defense counsel proposes a question that the military judge thinks is confusing or too broad or otherwise not appropriate, that if they deny it, then that's a per se rule that the trial, like everything that follows after that moment is unconstitutional. I mean, that's pretty extreme, isn't it?
I don't believe it is, Judge, and I say that because we've seen several federal court cases in which they've done exactly that. Pena, I was going to say Hardy, that's you. Nieves. There are other cases that we have cited in our briefs in which that is exactly what happened. And there was no requirement placed upon the appellant by the appellate courts to, as I said, jump up and down and say, no, I really mean it. We want this question asked.
Well, why not present a different question?
I think
with all a more refined question.
I think the question was very well refined. I think the question was asked was the appropriate vehicle to explore innate prejudices that could potentially be in the minds of the panel. I think that it was the right question to ask, and there is always a concern that when you refine the question, for lack of a better term, that you are losing the import of the question. The question as asked by the appellant counsel was whether or not anyone's cultural influence could influence their perception on relationships between individuals of a different race. That's the question that he wanted to ask.
If the victim had identified as Latino, would such a question have been required?
I'm going to caveat that with probably not, Judge.
So here, it was not presented to the military judge that the victim here did identify as Latino. The only way this court knows is because of the additional information that was provided on appeal.
Right.
Don't we have to examine the military judge's ruling based on the facts that were in evidence at the time the military judge did make his ruling?
Well, Judge, look at what the military judge did know. He did know that he had a witness list in front of him. The appellant's name is Anthony Ramirez. With all due respect, it would be hard to conclude that there is not at least a reasonable likelihood that that person is Hispanic.
I'm focusing on the victim.
The victim, yeah.
Well, he had the victim's name, which I, for some reason, is escaping me. But the mere fact that the question was asked, Judge Johnson, the mere fact that the question was asked, again, when an appellant asked, would anybody say that because somebody had one drink that they cannot consent to sex, we would not stand up here and say, well, there's no evidence that the appellant that the alleged victim consumed alcohol.
If this was a fundamental issue in this case, which you've suggested, how many times did the victim's or the appellant's race come up during the trial?
I would say that the answer to that is impossible to know. I say that for this reason, Judge Hardy, if you would allow me to. If you're asking me how many times was a question asked of the alleged victim about her race, the answer is zero. If you're asking me how many times did a panel member, much as we had in I believe it's Rosales, where a panel member came up afterwards and said, or a jury member in that case, and talked about how the panel room was infected with racial prejudice, I would say the answer is unknown.
But that's not the, I'm sorry.
Oh, please.
But, I mean, that's not the scenario we have here. Similarly, you early on, you noted that, I think you said, that the military judge not only should have known based upon the question that that there was going to be an interracial aspect, and then you pivoted to the affidavit that the chief judge mentioned that is part of the record now that asserts that the victim was Caucasian or Caucasian in experience, in appearance. But the military judge didn't know that at the time he ruled. Nor, just looking at a person, can you tell what their ethnic descent is. So how, again, if being, what's the standard in Rosales? Meaningful ethnic difference. How was the court to determine that if no evidence was ever put in or even asserted?
Judge, the question itself clearly puts before the military judge that there is an ethnic difference between the alleged victim and the accused in this case. By asking a question, does anybody's background give them, influence their perception of relationships between individuals of different races, clearly that puts the question before the issue before the military judge that we're dealing with an instance of an allegation of a relationship between different races. Just as if you ask a question about whether any of you have any preconceived notions about the consumption of alcohol, you are letting the panel members, you are putting the issue of alcohol abuse clearly before the military judge and the panel members.
But the military judge indicated by checking the box that he either found this to be a confusing question, a trick question, or not probative of the appropriateness of having the person sit on the panel. Why wouldn't trial defense counsel say, okay, if you're worried about it's confusing, I can clarify. If you think it's a trick question because the victim herself identifies as Latino, then I will clarify that she does in fact identify as Latino. Do you think this court has a legitimate concern that in a situation such as this, not confined precisely to these facts, but there's a question that comes up, the military judge finds it confusing, let's say, invites trial defense counsel on three occasions to ask for reconsideration, defense counsel sits back, doesn't say a word, and that is an exploding time bomb later on appeal where the argument is, that's structural error. You have to go back and start from square one. Is that a legitimate concern on the part of this court or not?
I think the more legitimate concern on the part of this court is that, A, the military judge is the gatekeeper. And it is incumbent upon a military judge, if he or she has questions about why this question is applicable, and again, there's no other area of voir dire where we're going to do this, but if we're going to look into this fundamental right of an accused and select it out for extra scrutiny, then that extra scrutiny should be upon the military judge as the gatekeeper, not upon the appellant.
Mr. Cazera, may I ask a technical question? Throughout your brief, you use the phrase racial and ethnic or race and ethnicity. Is there a distinction between those two? For example, can people of Hispanic heritage be of any race? And does the question get at ethnicity? And do we actually have different races in this case? And I just noticed that the question asked about race, but throughout your brief, you talk about race and ethnicity, and are they the same? Do we treat them the same?
Judge, there are people with PhDs that have been grappling with that same question. I would say that my best answer is, in this case, they are the same. But certainly, in my state of New Mexico, we have people who are Hispanic of Spanish heritage. They can be Hispanic of Canadian heritage. I can see an instance in which they are not the same, but in this case, they are clearly the same.
I wasn't going to ask this.
Go ahead, Judge.
Since you brought it up, in the affidavit, however, the appellant does not describe whatever we're going to call that, the same. The appellant uses distinct descriptions for himself versus the victim. So if you're saying that they are the same, why are they being described differently?
Judge, I'm not following
okay.
your line of questions.
In the affidavit, the appellant, in asserting that there is a meaningful ethnic difference, says that, I think he uses the word, that he is of Hispanic descent.
Descent or heritage, I
yes.
forget which of the words.
For the victim, he labels her as Caucasian descent appearance. So different, a person, the appearance piece, you can be any kind of descent and look a certain way. And so like I said, I only sprang back onto that question when you said, well, no, race and ethnicity are interchangeable. In this case, they mean the same. I would submit that because the affidavit describes the two people differently, then clearly they must not be the same.
I think there's a simpler explanation for that, Judge.
Okay.
He knows what his ethnicity is. There's no way to know for 100% sure what her ethnicity is.
Because there's no evidence.
My family is half Italian and half Austrian Jew. I don't know that anybody would look at me and say, Mr. Casera is half Italian and have half Austrian Jew heritage.
Okay. All right.
Judge, that's actually my time. So subject to any further questions.
Further questions from the bench?
I do have one question.
Yes,
Mr. Casera, in this case, let's change the facts just a tidbit. Just a tidbit. And what if the military judge had not checked the box, but instead had on the record or by email or however he communicated with counsel and said, you know, I'm not convinced that this question is a meritorious question for the panel. Can you give me some more information here about this, why you think this is an appropriate question? And then counsel didn't respond. What would that be in your mind?
I think you're much closer to waiver than we are here.
I see. Now, what makes it difficult here, I guess, is that by checking the box, you're saying he either had a, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying he either had a sui sponte duty at that point to, since he's not going to ask for any more information, he had a sui sponte duty to ask the question or get clarification or put more into the question when he put it to the members.
Right. I would go back one step further. Okay, and I would go back to my analogy of the question about alcohol abuse. He would not ask, tell me why alcohol abuse. Your question about alcohol use is misleading or a trick question or whatever the triumvirate mm-hmm. of explanation that the judge gave was. He would simply ask the question. So I want to go a step further and say, no, what he should have done is simply ask the question. If he was going to raise the objection, then yes. If he was going to deny the question, then yes, I would argue that the military judge had a sua sponte responsibility as the gatekeeper to say, I'm going to deny that right now, but tell me why it is that you are asking this question. And if the answer had been, I withdraw the question, or if the answer had been silence, then we're much closer to waiver than we would be here.
And you're saying, couldn't one look at this situation and say, hey, look, that's what the military judge was doing. In essence, although he checked deny on the form or box or whatever it is, it sounds when you read the record like it was a conditional denial. In other words, I think this should be denied, but give me some more information. That's not how you don't think someone
don't
could read the record?
I don't see it that way, and respectfully, I don't think military judges are in the business of denying or not denying motions, not conditionally denying them. So, no, I would not agree with that assessment, Judge.
All right. Thank you.
Can I? Further questions? I know we're way over time, but
MO, Judge. I'm usually way over time.
Where does this sua sponte duty come from? Right. Even if you're relying on Rosales-Lopez, it talks about there being a reasonable probability or there being a meaningful ethnic difference, and it sounds like you want to convert that into any possibility or any ethnic difference. So where does this sua sponte duty come from in the absence of any evidence why this question is relevant? What's triggering that duty?
Rosales-Lopez says as follows, Judge. federal trial courts must make such an inquiry when requested by a defendant accused of a violent crime and where the defendant and the victim are members of a different racial or ethnic group. Respectfully, that is where the requirement comes from.
But the language doesn't stop. Right? They go on to explain what that standard means, and they say there needs to be a reasonable probability and that there needs to be a meaningful ethnic difference. Are you saying that every ethnic difference is a meaningful difference?
I'm saying that if you look at the studies that we cited and the ways that racial prejudice and the stereotypical view that some have of Hispanic males can permeate a case, it can poison a case, and that there is no way in the world to know whether or not that happened here. And that's what Rosales-Lopez
says. But it sounds like you're saying yes, that every ethnic difference is a meaningful ethnic difference for the purposes of this case law, and that there is always a reasonable probability that the ethnic differences, potential ethnic differences between the victim and the defendant are meaningful.
I am loath to say every case because, there could very well be a case that I can't think of in which it's not. But I would say certainly in this day and age, given Rosales-Lopez, given the underlying potential racial issues in a case like this, that this one was respectfully a no-brainer.
Further questions?
Chief Judge, please indulge me.
Absolutely.
I hate to be the John come lately, but... even though my name is John. But what are we to make of the fact that, at least as I understand the record, and correct me if I'm wrong because you know the record better than I, but what are we to make of the fact that in this case, notwithstanding the question that was asked, that the issue of race doesn't really come up anywhere else in the trial? In other words, if this question was as important to defense counsel, as it is to you on appeal here, why did counsel not make it clear that this was something buttressing his case in chief?
Well, one of the reasons may very well be because the military judge didn't allow him to explore it. And had he been allowed to ask that question, and had he been allowed to alert the panel members to their own possible innate prejudices, that issue may have played a bigger role. I can't speak for why the defense counsel tried his case the way that he did, but I can speak to the fact that it is certainly possible, if not bordering on probable, that he altered his trial strategy because this judge did not allow him to ask a very basic and, in our opinion, required question.
But why would that prevent him from pursuing the issue on the merits just because he couldn't ask the question of the members? He could still pursue that as part of his case.
Well, again, Judge, I don't pretend to speak for the defense counsel.
I understand, but I
can certainly understand a scenario in which he said, well, the judge didn't allow me to explore this area, therefore I'm not going to explore it on my cross-examination of the victim.
I understand.
Okay. Counsel, I'm sorry. Chief Judge, thank you. I want to be sure that we are using concise language. What the military judge denied by checking the box was question number 16, which would have been used in general voir dire. My reading of the record is that, in fact, during individual voir dire, the issue of race came up, and the defense counsel had the opportunity to further explore it, as Judge Sparks is noting. So not only on the merits, but during individual voir dire, race came up. Several of the veneer men raised the Fort Hood case. One veneer man in particular had a fairly lengthy discussion about it, and yet there was no further pursuit of the issue. And so if that was the case, then again, that goes back to if this was going to be a central point or tenet of the defense, defense counsel had ample opportunity in individual voir dire to pursue that line of questioning.
Judge, I would respond to that the second prong of Rosales-Lopez is different.
Okay.
The second prong says where the defendant and members are different of a racial or ethnic group. So that is the language that I would ask this court to look to, that the threshold question asked by the defense counsel was whether or not, and falls squarely under Rosales-Lopez, could have been written directly out of Rosales-Lopez. So I think that the question is fairly covered.
Okay. So that goes back to the essentially the point that Judge Hardy made, that you're asking us to conclude that there's a per se rule with regards to the ethnic difference when there's no evidence in the record really to support that.
Well, I think again,
just by virtue of the question, the way the question
again,
is phrased.
I think we're disagreeing as to whether or not there's evidence in the record, but
okay.
your second part of that is correct as to whether, you know, the issue was squarely before the military judge. Am I asking for a per se rule? I'm not Congress. I tend not to ask for per se rules. I'm certainly saying that in a case like this, in which the defense counsel asks a question that squarely falls under Rosales-Lopez, as Rosales-Lopez says, the court has an obligation to ask that question. I don't think that that's as radical or as drastic of a remedy or a question as Your Honor's question was. I think that it's a fairly narrow request on the part of the defense.
Okay.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Cassara.
Judge, I went 11 minutes over. I don't know if I can give you back 6 minutes, but.
Captain Miller.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Stuart Miller, and I, along with my co-counsel, Major Chase Cleveland, represent the United States in this case. The Court of Criminal Appeals properly found that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying appellant's proposed voir dire question that read, does anyone's cultural background influence your perception on relationships between individuals of different races? In examining this matter, there are two conclusions that the CCA arrives at that this court should find are supported both by the facts before it in the record as well as an analysis of the associated case law. The first conclusion is that the military judge's denial of this single, broad, voir dire question did not constitute an outright denial of appellant's ability to inquire into racial biases. Appellant's denial of opportunities to request reconsideration or examine those issues during individual voir dire clearly demonstrate appellant was not overly concerned with examining racial bias in voir dire. The second conclusion is that if the military judge did, assuming for argument's sake, deny appellant of the opportunity to examine these panel members, prospective panel members, on the issue of racial bias, that was not a clear abuse of discretion, as the appellant failed to demonstrate how race was inextricably bound with the performance of trial, or did he assert any meaningful ethnic difference between himself and his victim.
So, Captain Miller, writ large, why isn't Mr. Cassara correct? We're dealing with a constitutional question, the issue of protecting the constitutional rights of this accused, other accused, when it comes to the right to a fair and impartial jury. We're dealing with an issue of that's particularly corrosive, racial animus, racial bias. This question specifically talked about different races. It's right there. So in light of Supreme Court precedent, why shouldn't the military judge simply have said, counsel, explain to me why you want to pose this question?
So, Your Honor, I believe that the answer to that last question, the specific question about the military judge posing it to counsel, so counsel provides these proposed voir dire questions by close of business on 18 June. It's a Friday. And the record shows that over the weekend, at some point, he provides counsel with his ruling, where he shows which questions he will allow to be asked, which questions he believes are more appropriately to be asked in individual voir dire. And then he adds, if you want reconsideration of any of these rulings, please submit them in writing by 1700 on Monday. He receives no request for reconsideration in writing. When court opens on 22 June, that Tuesday, he again says, did you get my ruling? Do you have any questions? And counsel, at least three times in the joint appendix between pages 26 and 27, makes very clear, I'm not objecting to your ruling. counsel goes as far as to ask clarifying questions about certain aspects of the voir dire ruling with respect to combining questions and moving questions from group voir dire to individual voir dire. So the military judge is properly exercising his authority in the performance of voir dire pursuant to rule for court-martial 912 throughout the process, and even says, I'll entertain additional, you know, voir dire issues or requests on the fly.
So how much deference should we give to the military judge's ruling, though, when in the way he did this with the matrix and the comments, he makes no comments? And then in terms of the box that he checks, he kind of covers the waterfront. He's talking about these three different things. It's unclear, it's a trick question, or it's not probative. I'm not using the language he used, but essentially it's not probative of the issue of whether someone should sit as a panel member. What is trial defense counsel supposed to make of that? And what is this court supposed to make of that in regard to deference?
So in assessing deference, Your Honor, I would look at the plain language of the question that he sought to be asked, and then the terms that the military judge used in denying it, and just a plain reading of it. I'm not sure how much more explanation the military judge could have given. The question on its face was confusing. And an answer.
But how confusing was it when there's the specific, it was not a model of clarity in terms of a simple declarative sentence or question, granted.
Yes, Your Honor.
But when there's the language in there talking about the victim and the accused being of different races, doesn't that tell the military judge what the military judge needs to know when it comes to Supreme Court precedent and this issue of racial animus and bias?
So, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I don't think that the wording of this question, sent up any sort of red flag for the military judge to be on notice, as defense counsel suggests, that this was going to be a prominent issue in the case or that it was something that the accused was overly concerned about. And when you look at the 60 proposed voir dire questions, the fact that only one of them is inquiring into this area even potentially, I think adds additional credibility to that argument.
So from your perspective, the government's perspective, are we dealing with forfeiture, waiver? What are we wrestling with here?
So in Your Honor, the Court of Criminal Appeals kind of moves right past that and does their analysis based off of Witherspoon. But that the issues is preserved. However, I think that based off United States versus Cesare, which we cite in our brief, I believe that there is an argument that there was at least forfeiture of this based off the repeated decisions for reasons only known to himself. I'm using language from Witherspoon. When defense counsel just moved on, when the military judge announced his findings or his decision with respect to these proposed voir dire questions, and defense counsel kept things rolling, moved into a group voir dire. They individually voir dired every member of the panel. And there were no issues raised at any point, and the record, even to this point, is still devoid of any ethnic difference between the appellant and the victim. We have an affidavit from the appellant stating, I'm of Hispanic heritage, and the victim, well, she looks like she's of Caucasian descent and appearance. So this court can't make a finding of fact that there is any ethnic difference, and there's no cases that I've reviewed in my research of this case and this issue where an appellate court was confronted with the issue of, well, we don't even know if there's any ethnic difference, which falls far short of what the courts have described as a meaningful ethnic difference.
So it sounds like the government's position, if you put aside waiver and kind of touch on forfeiture, maybe the government seems to be viewing this as the accused abandoning, and maybe that and forfeiture is the same thing. Is that how I read your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. That's in essence how my argument is. But the Court of Criminal Appeals noted the factual similarities between the case before the court today and United States versus Witherspoon. In Witherspoon, the trial judge rejected a question that was, as the military judge in that case, called too broad. And that question was, is any panel member in any way racially prejudiced? So a much more specific question, a less confusing question, but nonetheless, a question that the trial judge said was too broad. And when the defense counsel in that case failed to offer more specific questions or even, you know, challenge the ruling or object, the court found that it didn't even rise to the level of an outright denial of the opportunity to inquire into racial bias because counsel moved on for reasons only known to him, whether it be trial strategy or otherwise, or potentially that race just wasn't a salient variable in that case.
So what about Mr. Cassara's argument that if trial defense counsel had been provided the opportunity to ask that question during voir dire, we don't know how that might have played out in the court-martial in terms of once the trial defense counsel knew that the panel members who were sitting did not have this racial bias or animus, then may have raised issues with the victim, why she may have claimed that there had been a sexual assault. How are we to understand or know what would have happened differently in the course of this trial if the military judge had allowed that requested question to go forward?
So, Your Honor, a review of the record, as noted in the questioning of defense counsel today, race doesn't come up again.
Mr. Cassara's point is it very well might have if the question had been posed and if the trial defense counsel's confidence level was higher, that he didn't have a bigot or more than one bigot sitting on the panel.
So Your Honor, it's difficult to assess how it might have affected the panel. However, in looking at Pena versus Colorado, the inciting Rosales-Lopez, they talk about how generic questions generic questions about juror impartiality may not expose specific attitudes or biases that can poison jury deliberations, yet more pointed questions could well exacerbate whatever prejudice might exist without substantially aiding and exposing it. So I think that in response to your question, Your Honor, that the military judge is properly exercising his authority in reviewing these questions, both substantively to make sure they're not confusing, but also in examining issues such as racial bias.
So how does that square with Supreme Court, where they're saying if it's requested by the defense, they're making their own calculation? Why should the military judge be stepping in and making a paternalistic decision contrary to the desires of trial defense counsel?
So, Your Honor, that Supreme Court precedent discusses how this line of questioning is not required in every single case, but rather when there is an assertion of a meaningful ethnic difference. And the military judge is, you know, in the best position to make that determination based off arguments of counsel, which might include statements as to the ethnic differences just at that point as they exist between the two parties, followed by some sort of argument or suggestion as to how it would be meaningful within the context of the trial.
I'm not quite sure I understand on one point. How, since we're dealing with a voir dire question rather than instructions,
yes, Your Honor,
how would the military judge know how race is going to play out in the course of the trial?
Well, Your Honor, just he won't know how it will play out in the course of the trial. However, he will, as the party responsible for performing voir dire, have the opportunity to hear argument as to how there is any meaningful ethnic difference at the parties at that point, which, again, would guide his decision and understand the necessity for those questions to be asked. And Your Honor, in reviewing this, defense counsel in their brief concedes that this is not the constitutional standard Rosales-Lopez outlines, wherein race or ethnicity is inextricably bound with the performance of trial, but rather we fall into that second category, the non-constitutional or the supervisory standard. And based off that, the lack of any assertion of a meaningful ethnic difference, this court should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion. And specifically note that even on appeal, it is not clear, as counsel said, 100%, what the ethnicity of the victim in this case was. And because of that, the military judge did not abuse his discretion. He denied a broad, confusing voir dire question and the counsel continued moving. There was no objection, there was no issues, there was no legal argument, factual argument at that time, and this court should find the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion properly addresses the issue and affirm their findings.
Questions from the bench? Seeing none. Thank you, Captain Miller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Kassar.
Chief Judge, I'd like to start with 2 points. If we are in trial and an appellant makes a hearsay objection and the military judge says your objection is denied, we do not require the appellant to stand up and go, no, Judge, I really mean it. I have a hearsay objection. It seems contradictory to the appellant that in this one area of the law where the Supreme Court has placed a much stricter imprimatur upon the ability of a military judge to deny a question and much more concise restrictions, that in this particular area, of all areas, we would require an appellant to renew his objection for some reason. That would seem to be to defeat the entire purpose of Rosales-Lopez.
Does it matter that with a hearsay objection issue that we're not dealing with structural error? In other words, the death penalty for that trial?
I think that it inures much more to the benefit of the appellant. And the reason I say that, Judge, is you look at a Batson v. Kentucky. Okay? If it is a structural error, we do not require, once an appellant has made a proffer or made an objection on a Batson challenge, and if the judge overrules that Batson challenge, there's nothing in Batson or its progeny that requires the appellant to stand up and go, no, I really mean it, Judge. I object to your Batson challenge.
Mr. Cassara, what about Captain Miller's point about what the record actually says, and that defense counsel actually said, I am not objecting to your rulings. I'm not objecting. I mean, that's more than just sitting on your hands, right?
I don't think that that is as broad in the record as Captain Miller wants it, the court to believe it is, okay? And two, I think that what he's really saying is, I understand your rulings, let's move on. I mean, the judge has ruled. There is, you know, again, there is no requirement. If I say, I object to this person sitting on the panel under United States v. Batson, or Batson v. Kentucky, excuse me, and the judge says, well, I'm letting him sit, you're not required to stand up and go again, no, I really object. You've made your objection, you sit, trial moves on.
But in this, in the facts that we have and what the record discloses, defense counsel sought clarification on other matters. So if defense counsel could seek clarification on some other point with regards to the how many, 60 questions, why are we to say, oh, he should not, when given ample opportunity, sought clarification on the ruling on question 16?
The answer to that question lies plainly within the language of Rosales, in which the Supreme Court says that under our supervisory authority over the federal courts, we would require that questions directed to the discovery of racial prejudice be asked in certain circumstances in which such inquiry is not constitutionally mandated, mm-hmm. and denial of the defendant's request will be reversible error when the circumstances of the case indicate that there is a reasonable possibility that racial or ethnic prejudice might have influenced the jury. The court then goes on to say,
What were the circumstances in this case that established the reasonable possibility?
The government cannot prove that this argument, this issue, excuse me, this failure by the military judge is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because we have no way in the world of knowing.
Why is that the standard? We're not dealing with the constitutional rule. We're dealing with the supervisory rule.
Why would
that be the standard?
Right. There are certainly tentacles or facets of the first prong, the constitutional rule. The language of Rosales-Lopez, even under the supervisory authority, is nearly identical.
But then why label one as the constitutional rule and the other as the supervisory rule? What is the, if you're saying they're both constitutional rules, we can treat them the same, why bother describing them as such?
Right. And I think that the answer to that lies simply in the question that the way that the Supreme Court, and if you look at Ham v. South Carolina versus I think the other case that we cited was Penny Rosales. I'm getting the names wrong. Penny Ramirez, I believe. The difference lies just simply in between what role did race play within the trial. In other words, I think it was the Ham case where a black defendant was charged with a drug offense and his argument was that the police had framed me. That's certainly a different animal than what we have in this case. But the Supreme Court certainly uses this very similar language in stating that federal trial courts must make such an inquiry when requested. Respectfully, members of the court, I want to make sure that we're not losing the forest for the tree. The Supreme Court did not say, this is a really good idea. The Supreme Court did not say, you know what, if an appellant proffers and makes a special proffer before the court, that maybe you should do this. The government's argument is not with Bill Casera. The government's argument is not with this court. The government's argument is they simply disagree with Rosales Lopez, as they say in their brief.
I see your time has expired.
My
further questions
expired,
from the bench?
Judge.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Casera.
Yes, sir. With all, I'm sorry, Judge, very quickly, just in conclusion, based on that, the appellant requests that his conviction be reversed.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. The court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you.